Before we jump in, a warning that we are an explicit book podcast.
Yes, that means swearing, shitty jokes, and a whole lot of dark humour that some may take offence to.
Please check your trigger warnings on all of the books we cover.
You've been warned.
The episode starts in 3, 2, 1.
A book and a bear.
Everyone, and welcome back to a Book and a Bev podcast. This week we are diving back into True Dark with God's Grave by J. Kristoff, aka book 2 in the Never Night series. This book was published in 2017 and is just good. It's really fucking good. We follow our female main character Mia as she decides to fuck the church, and I mean, I just watched that Russell Crowe movie called Gladiator and I want in.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
She's raw dogging the church.
Sorry. I'm more so picturing like Sidonius as Russell Crowe in Gladiator. Like they're the vibes I'm picturing. Oh, George's vibes are just raw dog and churches.
Beautiful. Hey. Beautiful. Well, yeah. On that note, we are obviously your co-hosts, Bryony, Georgia, Ellie. Georgia, don't mind her. She's just raw dogging the church. The rest of us are being completely reasonable people. And what are we drinking? Ellie, what are you drinking?
I have got water and caffeine tonight. Water because I feel like I don't need anything to help darken my soul. We're already there. Okay. And caffeine because I'm just a tired bitch. So
I am drinking something that is dark enough for 3, aka a Jack and Coke with 3 shots of Jack in it.
Nice.
Jesus. Hey.
That's very Monday.
Happy Monday to me.
All right, well, I'm drinking red wine because I had leftover from last week, and it's for the blood that was spilled.
Ooh. Yeah, there's a lot of that.
There is a lot.
She dips her helmet in it and everything.
She does. That was kind of hot.
Kind of hot. So hot. On that note, what did you guys think of the book?
Well, I really enjoyed it, but it may just be my little simpleton brain, but the writing style really threw me for a loop. It was tripping me up a lot to begin with, especially the bloody footnotes, because I get distracted and I skip to the footnotes and I'm like, where was I? And it's just, and sometimes it just felt like the narration just felt a bit too showy and pretentious. And I get that that's the vibe. It's not Jay being like that. It was intentional for the narrator, who I think is meant to be the old dude from the library. We don't know that yet, but I really would have loved a traditional like POV style book as Mia. I feel like that would have gone down a treat for me. But, you know, as you can tell, I don't do well with change. But that being said, I did love the actual plot of this book. There's like the perfect balance between smut and violence, which is just fantastic. Although I do have one qualm. I seriously thought Furion was her brother for a hot minute. And like she was having these weird vibes with him where she's like, I just want to jump onto his dick. And I'm like, please don't. Please don't. I feel like you're a blood relation and that's not okay. Turns out it's not. Thank Christ for that.
I'm really happy we didn't have incest. Do you know how hard it is? You guys know how hard it is to find a book without incest these days.
So last week when we were talking about where we were up to with this book, and I'm like, I'm up to this chapter and like we've just met a certain someone and I don't know what way it's going to go. And you're like, it does go that way. I'm like, hang on.
And I was like, you mean Darkin? And I was, and you're like, no, I mean brothers.
Yeah, I mean sibling. Please tell me. When you were like, yes, I'm like, oh God, no.
You're like, why are you so happy about this?
Also, I realized that her brother was 6 years younger than her and she's only like 19. So why would he be this adult man? I don't know. But that's where my brain went.
Well, what in the crack is this book? Because literally it took me about maybe 10 chapters, and then I was absolutely hooked. I definitely get what you were saying about like getting thrown off with the footnotes. Mine was more so I was more invested in the actual story and not so much in the footnotes. I was just searching the footnotes really, really quickly for like the quick little like funny bits, and then I was like, okay, cool, that's funny, haha, and then like moved on. But this book, honestly, it had it all. It had gladiators, violence, love, hatred, badass FMC, and the fucking plot twists were throwing me for a 6. Bryony can contest. Like, I was literally Snapchatting Bryony my thoughts throughout the day on Sunday, and she didn't open it until the end when I had finished the book. So she got the entire one thing after another of my brain being like, what the actual fuck is going on? But honestly, this book is one of my all-time favorites, I think. I think it overtook Nevernight for me even. Like, I just loved it.
I agree. I think I preferred this more than Nevernight as well.
Mm. I just felt like as soon as she got to like book two, it just flowed and I just loved it. But as I said, it did take me a hot minute to get into it because, like, you know, I hadn't read it straight after Nevernight. I felt like if I had, it would have been like top fucking tier. But I just think, you know, hats off to Jay. He's done it again. It's a great book.
Yeah, look, this book is just a magnificent little bitch. It is like an amazing example of how to follow up like a great book one. It has trials. It has mystery and intrigue. It has spice, which was more than I remembered it having actually. Like this reread, I was like, oh my God, look at her go. There's a threesome in like chapter one. Your female main character is like facing down death while also facing like a personal reckoning. And it's glorious. I love it. And I mean, the fight scenes alone, the choreography of like the Magni, just phenomenal. I did also love like the privilege storyline within it, just to be like kind of serious and not like all about death and dick. Like the Mia Leona comparison, I thought was really good part of the storyline. And it's not always like handled, like you don't necessarily get that privilege storyline in that way. So it was just a nice different take on it. And also like, I was so nervous for you guys to read this because obviously I recommended Nevernight and then loved Nevernight and that was great. And I was so scared after how badly Kingdom of the Wicked went. Like Georgia can attest, I'm at work being like, I'm so scared that it's going to flop. Like I'm so scared.
She
had palpitations, but I'm so glad you guys loved it and I fucking love this book. Before we dive in, I will caveat again, like there's only a couple chapters where we've got the Speaker and the Weaver in this book, but just a friendly reminder in case I refer to them by the wrong name, I've got the first editions before the Speaker's name was changed, so just in case that comes up, I think I can tactfully avoid it, but just in case.
And I got weird vibes when we were like wanting to fuck him. I'm like, please don't. He creeps me out.
I was like, he is strange. And what is going on?
Mia, calm down. Just get out your sucky sucky 3000. Yeah. Have a good time and get it out your system. You don't need that.
No, he's got like blood red eyes and all. Oh.
I'm not going to lie though. After reading Court of the Vampire Queen, I wonder if he's got a similar skill set to the vampire one that can manipulate the blood flow.
Blood, yes.
Interesting.
Yes. Anyway, we digress. Well, let's dive in. And just to start off with, I would like to take a moment for the three maps we get.
Oh, wow.
Three maps. Guys, technically four if you count the one at the end.
Bryony's flipping through the pages. She's so excited. Bryony,
it's so beautiful. And it's actually relevant. That was my map talk. Thank you for listening. We'll make myself a little jingle that we can put in at the beginning whenever I'm like, there's a map.
Yeah.
We should.
And then after the maps, we've got Dramatis. Personae? I don't know. Which was literally like a refresher. Who, what, when, where, why. And I thought that was very useful.
It is handy.
Yeah, I did not read that, so.
I didn't either. I was like, I'm sure I'll remember.
Yeah, look, me being the little nerd that I am, I read everywhere. I read the acknowledgements in the books. I'm into it.
Welcome to book one, which is called The Red Promise, and it's not a lead on her period.
Shout out to Alita and her baps.
I
hope you're doing well.
Oh, she's
speaking
got
of Alita's baps, chapter one is called Perfume. Don't know why that's relevant, but fuck it up.
There was no segue.
No.
And also, Perfume, while we're talking about the opening line of the book, which is nothing stinks quite like a corpse.
Now, I have to say, didn't we start with that last time?
Yeah, we started with people shitting.
Yep, back to talking about people shitting themselves once they die.
Aussie banter.
Wasn't I correct when I told you that little tidbit?
We start in the POV of a woman named Tear Drinker. And when I read this, I decided from now on, we must all have weird nicknames that demonstrate who we are as people. Or what we have been. So Georgia, myself, that's me, is smut fucker.
Ellie, that fits.
Ellie is milk drowner. She's a mum.
She's drowning.
Can't swim. She's not fucking swim.
Oh my God, yes.
And then we've got Bryony. Now, Bryony's name initially was going to be Death Dealer because she loves death in her books, but now we've changed it to Death Shitter. Because she has a lot of problems with her bowels and she likes books with death.
She does.
So much IBS.
It's the most iconic nickname. It's so relevant.
But yes, Tear Drinker. What a name. What a lady. She is in some kind of desert.
Look, I'm sure it's like Ashkahi or something, but I'm like, Ashikaki?
There have been too many deserts lately. I feel like we've just been stuck in a desert.
Mm-hmm. But she comes across these bunch of dead bodies, as you do in the desert. And she and her merry gang of slaver traders go to investigate the stinky smell. They find a very beautiful little girl amongst the wreckage, though. And they're like, whoa, what are you doing here, you little crazy lady? The girl puts up a fight, but Tear Drinker, given the name, ends up getting her in irons and drinks all her tears. but basically, she's to be fed double rations, and Tear Drinker thinks her luck will change with how much she's going to get from that crazy little woman. We get this quote, which is, between the raiders and the slavers and the sand kraken, the whisper wastes were no place for a girl to roam alone. The Tear Drinker to have found her before someone or something else did, one of the daughters had to be smiling on her. It was almost as if someone wanted it this way.
Ooh.
Dun, dun, dun,
dun. Almost like it was a plan. Basically, for like book one of God's Grave, we're jumping back and forth between two time periods, and you don't really know that until you know that. So it makes it a little bit hard sometimes reading this first bit, but bear with us. So we're in a flashback, and Mia is at the opera, but is looking for like a target. And can we get a moment?
A nearby target store.
She's like, I've got a Coles Myer group voucher and I'm really keen on their new linen work apparel range.
Well, speaking of, it is quite nice. So.
It is so nice.
Yes.
Anyways, can we get a moment for the outfit though? The quote we get is, Mia was clad in an off-the-shoulder gown of blood red, layers of Lycian silk flowing to the floor, her half-cut corset was cinched tight, a string of dark rubies spilling into her cleavage, and while she appreciated the effect the corset and jewels had on emphasizing her assets, the admiring glances she'd been getting all Nevernight didn't make it any easier to bloody breathe. Her own features were covered by a face of Isana, a mask depicting the warrior goddess's helm, a plume of firebird feathers about the edge. Her lips and chin were bare, which made it a little easier to drink and smoke and swear.
Beautiful.
She's so fucking hot.
She's really hot.
Say that now that she's an adult. She's 19 in this book.
Yeah, she's an adult.
Thank God we've aged. But that description is like a House of CB dress.
It actually is.
Yeah. Jay, you've been doing your research. She's keeping up with the trends. But okay, so we're with Mia now and she's found her target, which is a senator's son, but he already has a woman with him. So she's like, look, this could be a problem if I let it be, but fuck it up. I don't mind sharing. Let's have a threesome. And look, chapter two, threesome, menage a trois. Mia is not letting the girl, which her name is like Alina, I think. They're getting a little bit frisky, but she's not letting her kiss her on her mouth lips, but she is happy for her to play with the other lips. So she ends up like drawing the guy in and like nibbles his little lip, and it's like hot and steamy, and like they're kissing, and then she's getting kissed elsewhere, and it's like, oh my god. And then he just starts like coughing up blood, and it's like, oh
wow,
quick side turn. So we sort of leave that there and we flash forward back to the current time, and we're, you know, Mia's a slave, remember, and she's just biding her time in the slave wagon, and they end up getting raided by like just a bunch of randos in the desert. So Mia, like being Mia, breaks out and kills them all and saves her captors, which is odd given that she is a slave and they are her slave captors, but we carry on. So Tear Drinker is like, well, why don't you tell me like what you want, because you just saved my life, so I feel like I need to owe you, like I may be your captor, but I am a fair person, so let's have a little trade off here. And Mia says to her, I just want to go back in the cage, please.
Yeah.
If you wouldn't mind, like, just pop me back in.
And open like, that cage door.
And they're like, well, we just kind of broke out of there, hun. Like, what's the situation? We don't know yet, but here we are.
We're getting hints at a plan, but we don't know the plan. But it's coming.
Hence why I was so confused.
Fair.
You're like, what is the plan?
We were just getting eaten out by some random girl, and now I'm in the desert again.
Next chapter, we're flashing back to Mia committing murder. Don't know why I've said it like that. Unfortunately, our shadow demons forgot who was meant to be on watch, and so a guard comes knocking. She makes it out, but the guards are dead. definitely in hot pursuit. So she goes running for her hand, not her like right hand, because her left hand isn't working on getting her off. No, it's a boy named Dove.
Yeah. Which I know is also, it's a lot. We're jumping.
It's a lot.
Just go with it.
And isn't Dove That's like fine. A body care brand and or human actress / singer?
Oh, could be anything. Hammered?
Yeah. If one of you has a child in the future, please call them Dove. Male or female, I don't care. I just
Yeah, look, we've got Dove. Options now. You're either Dove named after the professional female successful singer or Dove named after the assassin servant who died very promptly.
Yes.
Spoiler!
Yes, so that is exactly where we're at. She's shot in the ass, Mia, while she jumps on her horse, sick. But Dove is also promptly shot. So, goodbye, Dove.
Yeah, look, she's losing blood fast because, again, she has been shot in the ass, so that's unfortunate. But she ends up making it to the cemetery and is, like, trying to hide there, but she's surrounded and, like, nearly out of options when, all of a sudden, a shape rose up behind the guards, hooded and cloaked, blades of what could only have been gravebone in its hands. Not human, that much was clear. Oh, it was shaped like a man beneath that cloak, tall and broad-shouldered, but its hands, fierce and blood, the hands wrapped around its sword hilts were black, tenorous and semi-translucent fingers coiled about the hilts like serpents. Mia couldn't see its face, but small black tentacles writhed and wriggled from within the hollows of its hood, pulling the cowl lower over its features. And though it was near summer's deep, two suns burning high in the sky, its breath hung in white clouds before its lips, Mia's whole body shivering at the chill. Tentacles on the face.
Yeah, no.
Is it Zoidberg?
It's a hard pass for me. Whatever's going on there, it's just a no.
Very creepy. And whatever this creature is, it knows Mia's name. And it says that, like, her need for vengeance is blinding her from something greater. And it tells her to seek the crown of the moon before it yeets. So that seems super cool.
It's like, do better, Mia.
Do better. Have a bigger picture, set more long-term goals.
Oh my god. But I also hate this trope in books where it's like there's this mysterious character who's speaking in riddles and that person gets revealed as someone that we formerly knew. And it's like, well, like if we know who this person is. So imagine if they were just like, the Red Church isn't what it seems, Mia.
Yeah. Wake up. You thought I was dead. I'm actually now have tentacles on my face. What's
up? Hi.
Imagine me going down on you now. We're all unsettled. It's fine. No. Speaking of tentacles.
No. I don't even want to know. And
no. Ellie, just keep going.
It's right here. It's right here.
Oh my god.
Crack and sacrifice. I knew.
I'm just ignoring you. Okay. So we're back in the current timeline and Tear Drinker has managed to get the slaves to the Hanging Gardens, which sounds delightful. And it's described as such because it's a red stone city covered in thousands of iron cages filled with peasants. Fantastic.
It is exactly what it says it is, really. Yeah. It's pretty self-explanatory.
Yeah. Yeah. So Tear Drinker is still trying to convince Mia that she could go free. She's like, remember that time that you like escaped the cage and then you wanted to go back into the cage? You're out of the cage again, so you can go.
Change your mind.
And Mia's like, yeah, nah, I'm cool here, thank you. So she tells Tear Drinker that one day she will call in her debt. She's like, just you remember that you owe me. And Tear Drinker's like, okay, farewell, crazy little woman.
I'm sure I'll never hear from her again.
The end. And that's when Mia is promptly put into a fighting ring. And she can obviously handle herself. We know this about her. And all these people are bidding on her. And we're like, oh, interesting. So she's found like this one particular person who's bidding that she wants to be sold to. So we're like, interesting. This is obviously part of her big plan here. And he's just not interested in her at all. He's just like, yeah, whatever. You're not my type. You may kill a man with your bare hands, but that doesn't impress me much, like Shania Twain says.
Yeah.
So she's like, all right then, all of you, hop on up, your turn. I've always wanted to try three at once. And it's like, wow.
Mia.
She's in her hoe face. That's fine.
I really love her dirty joke.
Which the target she's got. Right. So obviously this book is very gladiator-esque. So they've all got weird fucking like gladiator terms. So she's after a particular sanguila called Leonidas. I don't know. Leonidas? I'm assuming it's a Nidus. Leonidas. Yeah. One of those. Liam Neeson?
Oh, I wish.
Oh my God.
Okay. It's Liam Neeson. She's gunning for Liam Neeson and he's a sanguila. And then there's all these other things. So he's this a, is a great great. It'll be so fun.
Yeah.
We're then in a flashback and Mia is getting her ass stitched up and we basically meet a character called Ten Hands, who is the bishop of the Red Church based in a place called Galante. And we basically find out from this whole encounter that the church is still struggling to rebuild after what Ashlyn and Osric did in book one. So that's funny. But there's just a really fun footnote story in this bit about the tale. Well, it's not funny. It's actually quite sad. The tale of Flavius and Dahlia. And it's basically to explain the way that the church can't target people that pay them. Because an assassin had a target, had to protect this particular guy, ended up marrying him. And then his enemy was also paying the church to try and kill him. And they were just kind of being like, oh yeah, we're getting around to it. And then eventually this woman basically killed the love of her life and then killed the other guy as well. And I was like, wow, that's a lot.
I skipped right over that part.
Look, I'm very picky about the footnotes I pay attention to, and I just thought that one was really interesting. Seems super hectic, and I love it.
Yeah, look, if you guys want a rundown of all the footnotes in the book, just hit me up. Like, I've got that shit down.
We'll do a whole episode just on the footnotes.
Just on footnotes.
So we then jump to current Mia, and she's taking on those three men at once. It's almost too much for her, but she still gets there. We've all been there before. And in the end, she's covered in blood and curtsies in front of Liam Neeson, and he offers over 1,000 pieces for her.
Nice.
Which, sick. She just took three men at once, dude. Three men.
Surely.
Up that price.
Liam Mason's a stingy bastard.
That's right. His daughter isn't. His daughter was like, I appreciate the effort you're putting out there.
That's it. Then he gets outbid. Oh, no. But fear not. It's by his own daughter.
The
Donna
shock.
Leona.
Not to confuse with Leona Lewis. Don't even ask me why that came out my mouth. She's bleeding love all over the floor.
She is bleeding love. Well, it took me way too long to realize that Donna wasn't just everyone's name.
Yeah. It's a really common name.
But she ends up bidding like 1,001 pieces. It's that third man. It took that extra one, you know? But she really loves Mia. She's like, yeah, sick. She's hot shit. But she's like gorgeous herself as well, and she's super wealthy. And like Liam Neeson's like, all right, I'll let my daughter have it. You know, she's been through enough. She's been kidnapped enough times. And Mia's like, for fuck's sake, this is not what I wanted.
This is not the plan.
But nonetheless, she goes with Leona, and Leona's like, actually, no, I want you to call me Domina.
She's like, this
Domina,
is my,
like a domino, and she works for Domino's Pizzas.
She does.
You went
she's
there, and I'm like, she's actually a dominatrix, and this is her madam name. Like,
I think of food as well, because when you order from Domino's Pizza, it pops up with, like, about me as your delivery driver, and my parents have, like, this really awkward thing where ever we get pizza delivered, they greet the person like, hello, Patrick. We hear that you like Amity Affliction. And you follow the crows. How interesting. Tell me more. I'm like, leave this poor child alone. Anyway.
You're embarrassing me, Mom.
So we're now back in a flashback, and Mia is traveling back to the ministry. So we've reunited with our blood man, the speaker, and all of the Shaheeds. And, you know, after Cassius' death, things have changed. They've just shuffled things around. So Drusilla, who was like the old wicked witch, she is now the Lady of Blades. And Solas, like the weird blind guy, he has been promoted to the revered father, which is cool that they have such fancy titles.
Yeah.
I wouldn't mind that. Imagine
that.
I just want my children to refer to me as revered mother.
Yes.
So either way, the Shaheeds, they're just not thrilled about her generally. They don't really like her as a blade, but they're kind of stuck with the decision that Cassian made on his deathbed. And then she's also
because
got
she literally saved everyone.
Oh my God, everyone. Literally. And like, they're like, single-handedly killed hundreds of people to save them.
Yeah,
and they're just
not enough.
No, but remember that one time? Like, we don't really like you that much. So she does have this mysterious benefactor who's the one who's been like giving her all of her kills and like specifically requesting her for tasks. This kind of frustrated me because I'm like, Mia, you're a clever cookie, and yet you didn't pick up what that were putting down at that stage. And even I did. And I don't know what the fuck is going on. Come on. So she's now being sent back to God's grave, but Solas makes it clear that she's not to touch Scarve, because remember, he's like the guy that killed her father in front of her.
So are we saying Scarve or Scavia? Yeah. Or can we come up with another weird nickname for him?
Scabs.
Scabby!
Scabby.
Scabby.
Yeah. So she's not to touch Scabby Man. And remember, he tried to, he did, in fact, kill her daddy. So that's not great. She has to kill some hoe and steal a map from her. That's the plan. That's the game. That's the task. And like Mia has a few questions, but you know, she doesn't feel like it's her place to ask them. And she's pretty compliant with the church. We're not raw dogging them yet. So she's like,
no, not yet.
Okay, no worries. Like, I'll be off then. Off to find my hoe. See ya.
Yeah.
I love how it's like, yeah, that's the aim of the game. And then everyone puts their hands in it on three. They go, 1, 2, 3, go.
Yeah.
That's how they end every assassin's meeting.
It was a dead silent pause for me. And then by the end, yeah. Yeah.
So it's in sports, sometimes people put their hands in a circle. Yeah, yeah. And they come up with a game plan and then they all go, yeah, on three. And then they say like a catchphrase. And in this sense, it's kill hoes.
So we jump to current time and Mr. Kindly, bless beautiful Mr. Kindly, he has to let the Viper know about her change in plans, right? Because again, she is the slave in the trade. And... Leona and her, I feel like he's what, like the bodyguard basically.
I love rereading this book. I was like, oh, okay, so he's meant to be hot. But in my mind, first reread, like he was not hot. He was an old man. But then he's like, he's got one leg and he's ready to go.
He's Captain Feathersword.
He is.
Beautiful. It works.
Captain. So Leona and Captain Feathersword appear and it looks like buying her has drained all the money in the bank. But Mia stands through, like, basically, Leona's like, you should probably get knocked out. Like, we should probably knock you out for this. It's going to be painful. And Mia's like, I can take whatever you've got coming for me. And it turns out that she's going to be branded, like, right under her eye with the, like, slave tattoo, basically. Yeah. And it's like an ice pick going in.
It's that Japanese tattoo method where they just literally, like, mallet it in.
Feels unnecessary.
Not nice, especially not on the eyeball area.
I would not be okay. I would be down on the floor.
Yeah, I would not even put myself. No, I'd be like, okay, yeah, you're offering me a way out, tear drinker. Sure, I will be tear swallower. Anyway, so Mia stands through the pain, though, because she is not us at all. She is a strong woman. But when it's finished, Mr. Kindly goes to tell the Viper to meet them at Crow's Nest, which just happens to be the homeland of Mia's family, her very, very dead family.
That is so unfortunate.
Twist of fate.
Yeah, lols. We then go into another flashback, and while Mia is at the church, she's decided to go to the library to see our bestie. And that makes sense because I would also do that. And she's returning a book to the Chronicler, okay, Alias. He'd given it to her 8 months ago. And we get this description of the book. The book was written by a woman named Cleo, a Darkin like Mia, who spoke to the shadows just as she did. Cleo lived in a time before the Republic, and the book was a diary of sorts, detailing her journey through Atreia and beyond. It spoke of meetings between her and other Darkin, meetings that had ended with Cleo apparently eating her fellows. The strange thing was, from Cleo's writing, she'd encountered dozens of other Darkin in her travels, and from the look of the woman's scribbled self-portraits, she was accompanied by dozens of passengers wearing a multitude of different shapes, foxes, birds, serpents, and the like, an entire shadow menagerie at her command.
Interesting.
Interesting. Eating a Darkin? That is interesting. This diary of Cleo's is in a language that only, like, Mr. Kindly and Eclipse can read, and it also mentions the Crown of the Moon, which, again, that was just mentioned by the weird guy with the tentacle porn, but that's fine.
That's fine.
Alias is again suggesting that she does not belong in the church, but Mia is again not taking the hint. That's fine. The Weaver then fixes her ass, because remember, she was shot in the ass. The speaker, basically, she's about to be strapped to the table. She's ready to, like, fuck 'em raw, but the speaker is like, FYI, I do still owe you for saving me and my sister's life in book one. So just got you eventually.
Jesus Christ. Who's fucking who raw now?
I just remember what the sister did to the other girl that fucked him, like the face issue.
naive. She just was like, actually, fuck your face, literally. Yeah. And not in like a I'm going to face fuck you way. No. In like a I'm going to fuck up your face.
Yeah, and that she did. Didn't disturb Mia, though. Mia was still like, you know, I'd ride that bloody dick any day of the week. Yeah. And it's like, oh, have you not seen his eyes?
That is some pink eye if I've ever fucking seen it. So just walk away from that.
We're leaving them there and we're going back to current time. And Mia is in Crow's Nest for the first time since she was a little weird child. And there are two other slaves with her now. A little boy called, I think of him as a little boy because he acts like a little boy.
He does, but he's a man because then he gets a boner. So
Mateo. Oh,
Mateo and Sidonius. And Sidonius has the word coward carved across his chest, which is super interesting. But it also just reminds me of that guy from Meet the Millers who has like the no regrets tattoo. So they reach the Crow's Nest and Mia sees the other 13 gladiati, which, if you're wondering, gladiati is another way of saying gladiator. But we're being special.
And so I don't know why we couldn't just say gladiator.
Because copyright.
It's Victoria all over again.
Yeah, so then Leona Lewis is out there and she's just like, hi, welcome. She sings a song of greeting and then she's like, these are my birds because they're called the Falcons. And if I had just joined and been sold into a team and was named a bird, I'd be like, of course, it's just my fucking luck, isn't it? Of course I'm a fucking bird.
You're a bird, I'm a bird. What are you talking about?
Yeah, oh, true. So Mia has a familiar sort of like lurching feeling down in her like nether region stomach area when she looks at one of the gladiati, and his name is Furion, and he is Darkin, not to be confused with brother, sibling, two very different things. She's getting like weirdly hot vibes from him again, and like my thought process, I know Bryony was like, he's Darkin, and my thought process was his brother. Look, it turns out he could have been her brother anyway, because they didn't fuck. So, I mean, they got very close to it because she just had like a loincloth separating her from his cock at one point.
And he got hard as well.
He did. So, yeah, okay, actually, no, take it back. I'm glad they weren't siblings.
We're in a flashback and Mia arrives in God's grave via the blood walk. Sick.
Yeah, I forgot about the blood walk.
And then she gets greeted by Jessamine. Is that, that's her name, isn't it? Jessamine?
I think it's Jessamine. It's like cinnamon, but not.
Mia is also greeted.
So hang on, stop, because now I want you to name your children Dove and Cinnamon. I feel like that's a really nice pairing.
Beautiful. So, greeted by Cinnamon, aka Jessamine, who is now a hand for the Red Church. After she cleans up, Mia encounters Hush. You remember him? He was like the mute guy
with the sign language. Yes. That was actually killing everyone.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. He was sick too.
And they seem to really like him much more than they like Mia. And Mia was very helpful and he killed a lot of people.
Yeah. They were like, we like your work ethic.
We run into Hush, yes. And the Bishop of God's Grave is actually Mercurio.
Great. Daddy.
He's a little bit daddy.
Jessamine is her hand while she hunts the Donna. Back in Crow's Nest, we meet Maggot, which is really, really unfortunate. Such an unfortunate name. Executus promptly hands their asses to them in a demo. Sweet. Sick. Furion fucks with her shadow control, so she loses. So also sick.
Thanks, Furion, awesome, for nothing. We're then in a flashback and Mia and Jessamine are scouting the Donna, and Mia ends up like infiltrating her clubhouse and ends up like helping a young girl named Belle, who is being forced to be a courtesan. Not to be confused with the young girl called Belle, who is in a French Parisian village.
Not as confused with Belle, who falls in love with the Beast and then gets a rose and then falls happily ever
different
after.
Different Belles. And then we go back to Crow's Nest, where we meet the magistrate.
Don't get me wrong, I definitely called her magistrate.
Yeah, her honour, magistrate. We discover that Mia has actually been purchased by the wife of the guy that she killed at the end of book one. So sick. That's so good. The gladiati then also have to bathe, eat and live together. Poor Mateo gets a hard-on from looking at Mia in the bath because of her baps. And I mean,
same.
But he's just like, oh gosh, so sorry. And she's like, it's fine. These baps are phenomenal. I had them built by the Weaver, so I get it.
Mm.
Mateo, Sidonius, and Mia basically get to know each other in the bath.
Get to know each other in the bath. Hey, what's up over there? Just having it, just flicking it in. How you going, yeah?
So basically from this get to know you, we realise what Mia's plan is. To basically win the games that the gladiators fight in. If she gets to the championship, it's in God's grave. And if she wins, she's basically awarded freedom by the two people that are at the top of her vengeance list, Scabby and the consul. And they're basically dressed as beggars. So they're ready to be stabbed.
Damn, Scabby.
Basically, first, they have to make it through this event called the winnowing and make it out alive. And yes, the winnowing is exactly what it sounds like it is. We're then in a flashback and Mia basically gets into this room dressed as the courtesan. Thanks, Belle, for the dress.
Sick. We get this moment where she breezed past the guards, but the footnote literally says, well, as breezy as one can get with a gravebone longsword and a bag of alchemical explosives pressed against one's crush.
Nice.
Which is brilliant. And it's not alchemical, it's not to be misconstrued with alchemical romance. The very, very
successful
bogan version of My Chemical Romance.
I was just going to say it was the very successful emo band that performs in God's grave on the weekends, but
Could also work.
The seller of the map arrives. Mia's just like, wait a minute. Your voice and your eyes are very familiar to me. Oh my God. It is Ashlyn Yharnam.
Oh my
gosh. Before Mia can even figure out what to do, the Donna is double crossing Ashlyn, but Ashlyn is a sneaky bitch. So she anticipated this, and the map container is actually like an incinerator, and a smoke bomb goes up, which helps Ashlyn kind of escape, but not before she recognizes Mia. So Mia sets off, a chase begins, she's in hot pursuit. Ashlyn ends up pulling out the Holy Trinity necklace, which she's just had stashed for this very moment, and it basically immobilizes Mia. But then Jessamine is there, so that's fine.
I really like it because I feel like if someone was to get me to back off, they would just hole up the Holy Cross and back at Crow's Nest. They are watching everyone else eat their dinner. Nom nom nom. As they're locked up for bed, we learn that the Executus is actually Arcadius. Arcadius.
He likes to go to the arcade on the weekends.
not to be confused with the arcade. Arcadius, basically a champion of his time, the Red Lion. So once everyone falls asleep, Mia steps through the shadows to explore. She goes on a little adventure. She goes and eats some food.
One of the other slaves, Wavemaker, was pissing in their dinner.
Yeah.
Yeah. He literally was just fuck you and your cow.
Yeah.
But then when you more about him, he's so lovely as you get to know him. It just feels really out of character for him to be pissing in people's oatmeal.
It is. Is he having a bad mental health state? Check on him.
Basically, yes. Goes to eat and then she goes to find Furion.
Okay, her brother in Christ.
her brother in Christ. She also calls him his brother. And again, we just don't like it.
No. If you're going to throw away, terms like brother and in arms or Christ or sister wife or however you want to phrase it, just don't make there also be some weird alchemical, if you will, attraction. Because for the simple-minded ones out there like myself, you say brother, I am assuming blood relation. There's no
not my brother in Christ.
Anyway, so we're in a flashback again with Jessamine and Ashlyn just going at it. Not in that way, but just with knives. Mia is still pinned on her back like a turtle because of the blinding light. So she's just shit.
Well, fuck.
Ashlyn's working Jessamine up, basically being remember that time when Mia killed your boyfriend last year? That was so funny, wasn't it? He was such a dick.
Haha, to you.
Jessamine's just I'm not okay with this situation, and just rips the medallion off Ashlyn's neck and is about to kill her when Mia's hang on, we have to take her alive because remember, she tried to kill a bunch of people last year and she succeeded, and the Red Church are going to want to speak to her. So Jessamine's backing off, but Ashlyn's not today, bitch, and kills her. Just really quickly. It came out of the blue.
She's just stab, 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 stab.
I was wow, okay. A lot of violence. We're fresh in, but okay, that's fine.
So hot.
And then she yeets her off the roof as well.
Yeah, and then she gets impaled. Yes. It's just a lot.
Damn! She could throw me off a roof and impale me any day.
Ooh, George is like, if that is how I go, that's how I go.
Mia manages to get the best of Aisling now because the amulet's gone, so she's risen. Aisling's just
risen from the dead. Yeah,
she's right. She's like,
she just literally comes upright. There's no pain in the knees.
But to save her skin, Aisling just starts talking to her, and she's like, look, we need a broad dog church, because it turns out they are in the pocket of the console. And Mia's like, not the PS5, but here we are. Because the console was in the pocket of the Red Church, it somehow means that the church had a hand in the death of Mia's father. Like, there's a lot of little dots that we've got to cross off here to get to that point, but that's where we are. And Mia's like, I don't want to believe you, but what you're saying is making sense to me. And Ashen's like, wait until I show you some proof, but it's back at the church.
So then we're in Crow's Nest. Furion barely like lets her up off the floor before Mia is like, how about we fuck? How do you feel about that? Are you picking up on the alchemical vibes that I'm picking up? But he seems confused. It's just her. It's one-sided.
He is subtly being like,
no. Then Mia looks at their shadows and we get this quote. Their shadows were moving of their own accord, her hair blowing as if in some hidden breeze, ebbing and flowing towards each other like waves on a lonely shore. Mia's shadow reached towards Furion's, though in the flesh the girl hadn't moved a muscle. The unfallen reached out and touched the wall as if to test if his shadow were real, but his shadow didn't move as he did, instead reaching out towards Mia's.
Ooh.
Ooh, okay, heebie-jeebie. Furion is all but performing an exorcism like right then and there. He is not aware of what he is and he is very distressed. He's like one of the faithful and doesn't want a bar of it. Mia basically is like, okay, I'm not going to get anywhere with you because you're literally a brother in Christ, and gets the fuck out of there. In training like a week later, Leona Lewis shows up and is singing Bleeding Love. She's actually standing on the balcony and she's like, I don't care what they say, I'm in love with you. And announces that they are on their way to the event.
Oh my God.
The new recruits are basically going to be put to the test in the winnowing. That's the synopsis.
Which, not to be confused with winnowing as in jumping to another place. Anyway, we go to the flashback and Mia goes to the church to get answers. She's going to fuck them raw. She bumps into the Shahid sexy stabby pants who talks to her about missing Trick and also offers to fuck.
She's like, I also had a boyfriend that died a long time ago and I feel your pain. Do you want to feel pain together?
It's okay if you cry.
Should we?
Let me hold you in all the places.
So they go through all the carved names of servants who died in service to the mother.
Which is, remember, like the goddess that the Red Church worships.
Oh, that's Mia, right. Goddess who died in service to the mother.
You're like, which... Who's mother?
Yeah.
I thought Mia's mum was dead. Mia's not mummy. Yeah. Drusilla?
It's all very confusing. So they go through all the carved names of servants who died in service to the mother, and they find proof of the church's hand in her father's death. So big dun dun dun.
Big
moment.
Dun dun dun.
Big dun dun dun.
Back in the current time, and they've arrived at the winnowing, and we get this moment where Mia sees children on their parents' shoulders watching the action. Because, you know, nothing brings the familiar together like a nice afternoon of slaughter.
My child's scared of the going on a bear hunt book.
Oh.
So I feel like he wouldn't bode too well.
No.
So the winnowing begins. Mia, Sid and Mateo and all the other recently purchased slaves are reenacting the siege of Blackbridge. Mia's team is a part of the historically losing side, so that bodes well. No one in Mia's team has any military experience either, but then all of a sudden Sid the Sloth starts like barking orders.
Deary me.
Mateo dies instantly, the poor sausage, so bye Mateo. And things are going dead downhill fast when Mia decides to think like a blade and not like a gladiator. So she puts the helmet of like a dead opponent on, slathers herself up in blood, and then grabs someone's intestines, holds them to her stomach and acts like they're hers falling out.
I love it. And I picture her going like, oh my God.
Basically, she uses the whole organs blood situation to get close to the enemy and then unleashes on them and kills them all. And we get this quote where she knelt by the bodies of those she'd killed, took off their helms and dipped the gold plume in the blood pooled on the sand, staining it red and slamming it back on her head. She dashed with swords in hand right at the ballista crew. Oh my Jesus God.
Christ.
Mia. Mia.
Jeez. Fuck me. Please.
Mia. So she basically goes to help the others, but the battle is over. Sid the Sloth has survived and their side won. And we get this moment where the big man grinned, clasped her forearm and dragged her into a crushing hug. Come here, you magnificent little bitch.
I really like that.
And then we end the chapter with Mia Corvair, the orphan girl, the darkened assassin, the embodiment of vengeance. She held her arms wide, dripping red onto the sand, and listened to the crowd roar in response. And just for a breath, she forgot what she had been, knowing only what she had become. Gladiatire.
Look, that whole scene was just...
I thought it was... Wasn't it Gladiati?
Gladiati? Gladiati.
In the narration.
Audiobook.
Which, by the way, it's narrated by a man. The whole time.
Oh wow.
That's why I took so strongly to it.
If your theory that the narrator is the librarian, then I get why you would get that as well if you've been listening to a man's voice the entire time.
Yes. So we're flashing back again, and now we are in Mercurio, aka Daddy's, point of view. Mia has decided to take her questions to him.
I've just decided that Mercurio is actually Pedro Pascal. Daddy is a state of mind. Daddy is a state of mind.
I'm not mad at that. I'm not mad at that at all. So we have a quote. He could see the blade in her, the killer they'd carved from the girl he'd given them. He knew that was what she'd become, sending her there. He knew the mark it would leave. You don't give someone to the moor without gifting a piece of yourself also. But beneath he could still see her, the waif he'd saved from the God's grave streets, the girl he'd sheltered beneath his roof, taught everything he knew, the girl who, even after she'd failed, he still thought of as kin, which is just very beautiful. But I still want to fuck him.
I kind of want to fuck him more.
I know. Thank you. Hi. He promises he would never hurt her. So I'm like, oh, okay. Say less. Like, bare minimum, but okay. So then Ashlyn hands over the Red Church ledger. It's like this little book. And she says that she never told the authorities about Mercurio's shop as she didn't want to hurt Mia. She managed to protect Mercurio's shop. So we get lots of information here. As it turns out, Remus attacked the church without Skaver Scabby's approval. Remus and Duomo are true believers, but Skaver is just like a power-hungry bastard.
Yeah.
He kind of sounds like Donald Trump, so
yeah,
here we are.
Ew.
Or he's doing a Vladdy.
He's a Vladdy daddy.
Oh, he's a Vladdy daddy. He is a daddy. Also, you guys imagine Duomo the cardinal. I just imagine the villain from The Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Yeah, me too.
Fucking hell, yeah, fair. All right.
Okay, Ashlyn still has the map, and Mia's mysterious patron, it turns out, is actually Skaver. So it's like, oh, wow, we're joining all dots. Ashlyn is on Mia's side and is committed to killing Duomo and Skaver and possibly taking down the entire church and raw dogging it while they're at it. And Mercurio is kind of like, hang on, girls, like things are moving at the speed of light here. I don't know what's going on.
I haven't raw dogged in years.
He hasn't. He's just like, you need to give me a minute to think about, you know, betraying everything I've known for the past 50 years. He thinks on it for approximately 10 seconds and it's like, fuck it, I'm in, let's do it. They come up with this crazy ass plan, and now it's all linking in about why we're with the Gladiati.
Then we're in the current time, and Mia and Sid are officially sworn in to Leona Lewis, and all the other Gladiati are proud of Mia's tactics, but Furion calls her a snake, so that's kind of rude. FYI, this entire time Mia has been without Mr. Kindly and Eclipse, so she's had to actually deal with her fear for a while, which is problematic because basically they appear while she's trying to go to sleep, and it's really cute. So whilst being drunk as a skunk, she shadow walks and the demons take her to her, aka hello beautiful, she smiled. Hello Ashlyn, Mia replied.
Oh. I loved it. I had like goosebumps. I was like, oh,
this is just making me realize how fucking straight I am, because I was not picking up on any vibes until they were actually fucking, and I was like, oh. Where I'm like, is this like the male gaze queer baiting? Like, he's just thrown in all this girl on girl action. It's like, no. Like, there were subtle signs throughout the entire book that this was what was going to happen.
The entire book, it was laid out like literal bread.
Yeah, no.
I feel like from here, you then go into book two, Blood and Glory, and the book really, like, it's hard to put down.
Yeah.
Ash and Mia regroup, but Mia is still like, I don't know if I can trust you, bro. Obviously, they discuss how the plan has gone wrong. Ashlyn is flirting with Mia, but Mia's just like, I can't see anything. I don't know what you're talking about.
She's Ellie in this scenario.
She is Ellie. So she heads back up to the barracks, but pops up from a shadow, like right in front of Sid. And he takes the news surprisingly well and says that he has been all around the world, so it's not really that scary to him, which I was like, wow. I was like, Sid, I love you. We find out that he served the true Justicus, which is Darius Corvair, a.k.a. Mia's daddy.
Wowzers.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Mia is then in training, but the training session is broken up because Leona Lewis appears and she has in fact sold one of the slaves to a pit fighting ring, and that's quite depressing actually. It's quite a somber moment. At dinner that night, the rest of the gladiators are fuming because Leona Lewis sold that guy, but Furium puts more in their place and it's very clear that he is loyal to Leona Lewis. He is in fact bleeding love for her.
Oh, he is. When they all go to sleep, Mia sets out to spy. I don't know when this girl sleeps. Every time they're all hunkering down, she's just gallivanting. So she walks through her old house, which is very sad, and she's thinking of her father and her brother, Jonan, not to be confused with Furion, not her brother. Mia sees Leona Lewis get out of the bath and she's like, oh, hello. And again, not picking up on what they're putting down here. I'm still just, her heart's beating a little bit faster as she's thinking of the woman from the beginning of the book. And it's like, all right, I need your opinions on whether this is okay. And after we've already like unpacked this a little bit, but I feel like I've been a little bit too woke now because I've been like, is this just like a little bit too male gazy, like queer baiting? I think if they didn't go into the relationship with Ashlyn, if it was purely just like her starting to have a little bit of girl on girl action in the first scene and then like just ogling women getting out of bathtubs, then it could have been.
Yeah.
But I feel like this has led on from Nevernight. I feel like there was tension in Nevernight between Ash and Mia. It was like that bond. There was something there. That kiss that lingered too long, I feel like it has been playing on.
Yeah, so purely platonic up until this point. I'm blindsided with all this brand new information.
And that is obviously like a criticism of this series, is that it is a man writing about a overly sexual young woman and it's girl on girls and it's fetishizing. I do think like in book one, Mia has, obviously there's a romance with Trick, and then the Ashlyn has feelings, but Mia's not there. And then in this book, she's actually realizing that something is there for her. If anything, she's realizing she is bi. There's that awakening, but Ashlyn is already there.
I think, yes. The problem is I'm someone who reads the most fucked up side of books. I'm reading these crazy dark romances. So to me, the thought of someone writing a fiction book about like a relationship, you know, a book that could be considered, I guess, controversial in terms of the sexual side of it, it doesn't really bother me. And I think as well, like with this, I feel like it's character progression.
Mm-hmm.
Like she's growing. And as Bryony said, like Ash is already there. Ash has always kind of given off that bisexual energy, whereas Mia is just kind of figuring that out. And I feel like it would be weird for her not to have these experiences as like a new adult.
And I also feel like, for example, if you made Ashlyn a male,
mm-hmm.
I feel like there wouldn't be as much like, oh, is that coming out of nowhere? I feel like the same lines, like a male character being like, hello, beautiful.
Yeah, definitely.
And she's curving on Furion and Leona in the same way. And I can definitely appreciate how you might not see it the first time, because I don't think I saw it the first reread. When I first read this series, I didn't know I was bi. And as I've reread the series, I pick up on something different every time.
Whenever you're reading something, you're reading it in the context of your own life and your own experiences.
Yeah.
And my life is just like putting up with penises. I wouldn't say liking them. I tolerate them, but I'm also not interested in vaginas. So like the kiss that lingered a little bit, I'm like, that's a lovely moment. They didn't want to say goodbye. I didn't even, it's just not on my radar. So then when we're like looking at women getting out of the bath, I'm like, oh, okay, that makes a little bit more sense now. And then now Ashlyn's involved. I'm like, oh yes, okay, I can see how this is all making sense. It was just me and my straight girl blinders on. Okay, so now that we've put that to bed, Ellie is on board. board with that. This, in fact, has been a queer love story from the beginning, and she was just ignorant to that, but that's okay. Our chemical romance, here we go. Mia overhears the magistrate comforting Leona Lewis. Leona will not beg her father, but the magistrate thinks that she should.
Weird vibes.
Interesting. And we also find out that the magistrate, like, breastfed Leona Lewis. I'm also weirded out by that. Yeah. That's not your mother's.
So am I.
Breast, that was that whole odd time period where it was like you pop the kid out. Even though you've got milk coming from your breast, you're like, I'm going to give this to someone else.
Yeah. Like, we're just a community of breastfeeders. Yeah. Like, child, come suckle. Why am I up? My name is quite fitting. Like, why do I always come back to this? Okay, now Arcades has entered the room. He and Leona Lewis are just having a bit of a chat, and Leona keeps him pretty off balance, basically just showing a little bit of cleavage and a little bit of leg, and he's like, holy fucking shit. And
I am aroused.
Arcades is, like, genuinely in love with her. He's bleeding love. And he's basically trying to push Leona Lewis to sell Mia so she can make back the money that she spent on her. Leona's like, okay, yes, look, I will agree to sell her after the next match unless some miracle occurs, and that may be a miracle. Mm-hmm. Mia watches Leona then creep around the house, and what do you know? She's fucking her brother. In Christ, Furion. They're just...
Oh. Furion is bleeding love all over, or in her, I should say. Well, actually, no, over her, because he pulls out and jizzes on her ass.
He does. Pull out game is strong with him.
Wow, the force is strong with that one.
So next chapter, we've got a quote. Fine work, Bryn said beside her. Where'd you learn to shoot like that? Read about it in a book, Mia growled. When I was done fucking your father.
Oh.
Beautiful. The banter in this book really gets me.
Mm.
Mia is then obviously in training with the twins, and Bryn is like an excellent fucking shot. Like, she can shoot blindfolded with both hands or with her feet. The twins are Equali, a subset of Gladiator who are in, like, horse-drawn chariot. Byron Bay.
Byron Bay.
Shields and drives the chariot, and Bryn is the archer, and they're, like, really fucking good. We get the twins' tragic backstory, and that makes Mia question the fucked up world for kind of, like, the first time. She feels as if, like, the scales are falling from her eyes and the true horror of the Republic she'd been raised in is unveiled. But even though she lost her parent, she had come from a place of privilege, and so she's living with that privilege. But unfortunately, she does not have the time to basically deeply consider the world she's in, and because she needs to get better real fast to avoid being sold again. So, problems.
Mia is then relaying the info she got from snooping to Ash. The only play they have is to make Mia's next win so grand that she cannot be sold off. We get this moment. Ash has gotten her some grapes, and it's this whole time because obviously she hasn't been able to eat anything because she's like a slave. Good grapes these, she muttered. Never let it be said that I don't love you, Corbear. Mia looked up sharply at that, but Ash was leaning back in her chair, dropping grapes into her mouth. Ashlyn Yarheim had lied to her. Ashlyn Yarheim was poison, so why had her lips tasted like honey? That is a fucking question. Ash makes it clear that she is there for Mia, not to repay a debt or her own vengeance quest, but because of Mia. But Mia's like,
no.
Yikes, I can't. So, Mia is in Stormwatch, and it's time for the next fight. Sick. Nice. Mia has drugged all of her other gladiati. Sure. So they basically have a very, very, very bad case of gastro, and they cannot compete. So it's a real shame. Damn. What's her name? Leona Lewis. She is like, don't fuck up, otherwise I will not let you forget it. And Mia's like, don't stress, babe. I've totally got this. Don't you stress.
So the Ultima begins, and basically a horror awaits. It's called a wretch worm, which is actually just what I look like after a big night out, but that's fine. Basically, Mia finds some tricks left by Ashlyn in the arena, but I mean, this thing vomits up its stomach, which then moves like it's alive, and then sucks it back in, and whoever is stuck to their stomach is sucked in as well.
It's like a giant fucking vacuum.
Yeah.
What a way to go.
Mia basically manages to get a bunch of word glass into this beast, but that fucker takes that very personally. It's on her tail, and turns out it can sense when Mia, like, fucks with the shadows and uses this as a chance to rip free of its chains. So that's cool.
Yeah.
It's terrifying.
Yeah. Look, I would be like, actually, just end it now.
So it is in chains no longer. Mia lunges for the worm and it should really like engulf her with the vomit because she's like running straight towards it. But because she like shadow walks to its tail, the worm just like swallows all of the word glass instead. So it's like, shifty little bitch she is, isn't she? So she climbs up its back, and as she hears the word glass detonating inside the worm, she stabs a spear through its ear. And it dies, essentially. And yeah. Everyone is like, holy shit. Like just silence for a beat. And then everyone just claps all at once. The crowd goes wild. What? She's just like covered in blood. There's still like word vomit around the arena. It smells a little bit.
But a little she's bit iffy. Just,
this is my moment. So the falcons, the weird birds that they are, they all just start celebrating. And Leona Lewis appears to sing a song. And Mia realises that she's not very good with money because she's just dressed immaculately at all times. Doesn't matter where she is. She's just
And it's one of those things where it's a new outfit every time. Like, she's not repeating. Mm-hmm. Expensive food and expensive wine.
That's when Mia's like, She was raised rich and then she married rich and then, well, he's dead now and she's got no more money. So she's like,
She's got rich taste, so she's kind of...
She does.
Fucked.
Champagne taste on a beer budget. We've all been there.
Oof.
True.
So then Leona Lewis pulls Mia aside and says that she has been requested at an honoured feast with her dear brother that I'm fucking. And they're calling her, this is her new name, the Saviour of Stormwatch. That's I like nice. That. That's got a nice ring to it.
Pretty fucking badass. It's not as good as Death Shitter, but it's a good second. Yeah.
Look, it's hard to get better than Death Shitter. So
it is.
But, you know, I appreciate the effort on her part, you know?
Yeah.
Saving the peasants and whatnot. So
Ash and Mia meet up and Ash hugs her and is like, dude, that was fucking sick, bro. Don't know why I turned into a frat brother.
A frat brother.
My brother in fraternity?
Yeah, fuck it up. So, Mia is upset, though, after finishing this tournament. She's very upset. And there's, like, this weird moment where the quote is, Mia drew in a deep breath, held it in for a long, pregnant moment.
Why is she pregnant?
I was reading it next to Claire and I looked up and made eye contact with Claire and she saw the horror on my face. She's like, I thought this book was good. And I was like, just read this sentence. And she was like, why is she pregnant? So she literally said the exact same thing.
Jay, your penis is showing. Your and not in like a flashing people inappropriate way. Like you're just writing about women in a weird way.
That's an odd saying to say, Jay. Anyway, weird moment, but sick. Anyway. So Ash goes to kiss her and Mia stops her and is just like, I don't fucking trust you. I thought I made this pretty clear. And like, among other things, you know, I don't trust you. And Ash is hurt by Mia's words and they get into an argument. And Mia goes, fuck you, Ashlyn. I thought you'd never ask, Mia. Don't pretend you don't feel it, Ash said, because it's written in your every line and curve. You might know me, Mia Corvair, but I know you just as well, and I know what it is you want. No, if Mia was afraid, it wasn't of wanting a girl. It was of wanting this girl. Ashlyn Yharheim, thief, liar, killer, traitor. How can I trust you, Mia asked, after all you've done? If I wanted you dead, Mia, I'm not talking about trusting you with my life, Ashlyn.
Oh my God. Is this the days of our fucking lives? Like, this
Trusting you with my life. So what's she saying? Trusting you with my body?
Trusting you with my heart?
I took that purely sexual.
With my heart.
More
the days of our lives.
Yeah, like sand in the hourglass.
But can we just remember that she killed her boyfriend?
Yeah, well, Mia technically donated her brother to death. So although she did not deliver the death blow, she was like, hey, speaker, snack.
Anyway, so it like gets like they're like face to face. There's about to be a moment, and then Mia's just like psych, jumps through the shadows and leaps through the window.
Literally jumps out a window to avoid it. It's fantastic. Mia is then brought in as the guest of honor to the governor's feast, and immediately it's evident that this is all a ploy by Leona Lewis's dad to basically get her to wager her best fighters in a fight she can't win. And Leona, being the prideful little dipshit that she is like, bet, I love it. But it turns out that Mia is not about to fight a man. It's something called a silkling. Basically, it is a six-armed, green, multi-eyed, really tall bitch.
That's a really great summary.
So it's basically Tear Drinker, because Tear Drinker was like 7 foot.
Yeah, look, it is essentially
but with six
actually
arms and green and lots of eyes.
It is the female version of Goro from Mortal Kombat. I see what Jay Kristoff is doing right now.
Yeah,
Mia is basically forced to fight this six armed monster until one of them submits, and she's not doing well, but gets a blow in, like just quick gobby, and then grabs the shadow.
Excuse me, everyone just pause right here. Let me just quickly whip out this one of its six dicks.
Oh my god, six dicks, that's too many.
Well, it's female, so it's just six clips. But again, someone, aka her brother in Christ, Furion, fucks with her grip on the shadows, and Mia is forced into like this fucked up position where Leona basically has to tell her to yield to the fight. Leona's dad uses the opportunity to put Leona Lewis in her place, but she isn't backing down. And he offers like a further bout in at the next like games to basically make up for it. And that's when Arcades steps in to basically say that like six swords versus one is like pretty unfair. And so like, especially when his favorite Furion was not in the ring. And then it's basically agreed that it will be 3 against 1. And Leona's like, that sounds fantastic, and I have no problems with this plan.
Sure. Gosh, she's so frustrating.
She's so dumb.
She's so dumb throughout this entire thing. I was just like, bitch, sort your shit.
Yeah.
So Leona Lewis and Arcades are fighting about who will compete. They agree on Bladesinger to be the third alongside Mia and Furion to face the Silkling. Sick.
Nice.
Training does not start off well. Mia is basically drawn to Furion, but it's not just because he's attractive. It's like something else, a hunger, the darkened thing, you know what it is. It's clear that Furion and Mia are basically out to just kill each other. Like, they are not having a good time. And Bladesinger is just trying her best to fucking survive.
Yeah.
So Bladesinger turns around to Mia and is just like, fuck him, stab him, stab him while you fuck him. I don't give a damn, but get it sorted before you get us all killed.
I like her.
I like her a lot. She makes a lot of sense. Mia then tries to talk to Furion to bury the metaphorical hatchet. And then again, their shadows start doing some weird shit. The quote we get is, the shadows were tangled like serpents, twisting and writhing and curling like smoke. They'd lost their shapes utterly, two amorphous slivers of blackness, each entwined in the other. Mia realized they were twice as dark as they should have been, just as when Mr. Kindly or Clips rode with her. The room was noticeably colder, her skin prickling with goosebumps, desire making her tremble. And moral of the story, Furion is like, again, not my vibe, hard pass. So that doesn't go well.
Not my monkeys, not my circus.
Yeah. He's looking at the shadows on the wall and he's like, no.
So Sid is then waiting for Mia when she steps back into her cell after shadow walking. And he's like, maybe you should just give Furion a quick handy and like that will ease all of your burdens. Mm-hmm. And she's like, bro, it's her bro, no.
It's my brother in Christ. I can't do that.
Sid then tries to convince her to run rather than face the Silkling. Apparently, Mia reminds him of someone, his old boss's wife, Aileen Clavaire.
Weird, weird vibe.
Well, when you think about it, it's not that weird. It is her mum.
I know, but
but it's like weird that he's like, you remind me of this one person who I used to like
specific person.
Yeah, yes. like, you know, it's not like, oh, you know, you remind me of like a summer's day. You know? It's like
you're actually
my old boss's wife,
dead
who
wife
I knew briefly, who is mm-hmm. now very much dead,
nice.
Deceased, no longer with us.
R.I.P.
So. Yeah, well, he calls Mia's mummy a stupid fucking whore. And Mia's like, I'll give you a stupid fucking whore, and begins to beat the shit out of him. And he's like, whoa, clearly I have misspoke. I am sorry. And then he's like putting together all of the things and he goes, wait, you're the stupid fucking whore's daughter, aren't you? And she's like, yes, I am baby stupid fucking whore, a.k.a. a magnificent little bitch.
Yeah.
Okay, so, baby whore.
Baby whore. We have another tiny whore. A tiny whore.
Oh, baby whore, baby whore.
No. No, not the baby born song.
How did that just come to your head? So he's very apologetic for doing that. And as Sid goes to comfort her, she's like, do you know what? Fuck this. I'm going to go fuck something else.
Oh, literally. She steps through a shadow and basically makes it to Ashlyn, and it is on. They are kissing. There is breast sucking, neck licking, finger dingle doodling, if you will. And the quote we get is, it was like nothing she'd ever known. Jolting current and sweet softness and kisses, endless paralyzing kisses that filled her with a warmth all the way to her fingertips. Time stood still, nothing but teasing tongues and breathless sighs, a heat building between her legs, setting her whole body aflame. Mia gives.
I love it.
Mia gives Ash a big O, so that's nice. And then Ash smacks her butt and ends up making Mia beg for it. And I'm like, whoa, okay, I love the power dynamic. Post fuck, Mia notices that Ash has like a really fun back tattoo. And it's that map, you know, that secret map thing. It's on her back. And it's an alchemical tattoo. So if she dies, the map disappears. So it's kind of like her life insurance policy.
Alchemical romance, if you will.
Yeah. For a minute, Ash is like, oh my God, was this your whole plan to seduce me so that you could see the map? They quickly figure out that Mia is just not that smart in that way.
She's like, no, I was just horny.
She's not, I could have been like, she's not that mean, but no, I chose different words and that's the bet I made. And she's chosen Ash. Ash is the pussy that she wants. She's committed.
I love that for her.
Mm.
One pussy for life, if she, that's what she's like. Oh, dear. But next chapter, Mia, Wave Maker, and the twins are all having a bath together, just a rubber duckies, and it's very cute. They've got like their little like bottles and like they're making concoctions in the bath, like they're making potions.
This is my boat.
They're playing mermaids in the bath.
Someone pull my tail.
Oh my god.
Ew. Anyway, we've got to keep going. Okay, so we learned that Wave Maker was in the theater and they all joke around. And then the magistrate, if you will, comes out and she's like, bitch, pull your fucking shit together. You are gladiati. You are not a bunch of mermaids.
Okay.
We jump to Furion and Leona Lewis and they're doing the dirty and he tells her to get rid of Mia. And she's like, dude, you're my slave. And he's like, well, fuck you then. And she's like, yeah, that's the fucking point, bitch. Before they can argue anymore, Executus comes to his door and she's able to like hide under the bed like a little ball. And Executus comes in and asks Furion to fight with Mia, not against her. So fight with her, not against her. Otherwise,
thank you for clarifying.
Otherwise, it will doom Leona Lewis. And Furion ends up agreeing with a little bit of pushing. But Leona, when Executus leaves, Leona comes out and she's pissed. She's screaming love, if you will. She's not bleeding, she's screaming. because Executus let slip that Furion was an animal before he was brought here. And she, like, really hates that about him. She's like, I know that you're a slave and, like, a gladiati and all, but, like, also, how could you?
How could she, you have a past before you knew me?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Ella?
She leaves his room in a huff and forgets her knickers, which is really unfortunate.
Oh, problematic. But then it's fight time again, and the trio is waiting for the Equalize match to finish, and then it's basically their time to face the Silkling. They watch the twins take their place and the race begins. And it seems to be going well, like they're close to winning. It's just like the Lions versus the Falcons, and the Lions is Leona Lewis's dad's team. So, you know, it's like, oh my God. But then tragedy strikes. They get a good shot in on the Lions archer, and their chariot careens into the barrier. But its wheel bounces off and into the twins, and they are tossed. Ooh. They're yeeted like ragdolls, and Bryn is the only survivor. It looks like she could still cross the finish line and win, but then she sees her brothers mangled, bloody, and burnt corpse and starts just, like, screaming while she holds the corpse in her hands.
Yeah.
Whoa. It's really fucking dark.
It
George,
is.
I don't want to hear it a fucking is. Word out of you right now.
I was really that entire time because it's just so, like...
It's so...
Talk about bad luck, like...
That wheel came out of nowhere.
Yeah, it's like and Final Destination shit.
It oh, is!
Yeah.
That's
honestly,
exactly what it is. Oh, my God.
It's just a horror story, literally.
There's no real time to grieve anymore, and it's time to fight against the Silkling. So...
Nice. Yay.
It's clear that Ashlyn was able to get info for Mia, which is nice to help her. But it's still up to the trio to win the fight against the fuck-off giant six-armed woman who fucked a spider.
Yeah, look, she's got multiple eyes, she's green, she's got six arms. It could be happening.
It could be. So the arena floor rumbles, and then it's starting to, like, rise into different platforms. And it's like, oh, this is such trickery. How cool. Furion has the nerve to seem a little bit angry about how Mia knows things. And she's just like, do you want to fucking win, Furion? Just shut the fuck up.
We have
stop
bigger
being so
problems.
Righteous. Sir. The fight then begins. And again, Furion is just like, I don't want you to call the shadows. If we're going to win, we're going to win properly. And Mia's like, but we can fucking win if we just do it my way. Anyway. Men.
Fucking idiot.
Yeah. So it also just turns out that Silken also has acidic spit.
Fucking so, that would be an awful gobby.
Yeah, it would. That would burn. That would tingle the next day. Bladesinger is getting a good hit in at the moment. She's doing pretty well. But the Silken is not happy about that. So Furion dives between them at the last second and starts laying into the Silken. But then she spits on him and he starts to, like, basically third-degree burns all over his, like, chest, neck region, which is not
the
ideal.
Neck in particular. I was like, oh.
Yeah, there goes your airway, sir.
Mm.
So, look, he's not in a good way at all. He's just sort of sizzling on the floor. And Mia is the next to dive in, but she's promptly kicked aside by the giant fuck-off spider woman. And she gets some lovely broken ribs.
Mm.
Bladesinger then gets up again and gets a good blow in. But by doing that, it sort of catapults her back off of the platform. And she's like dangling off the edge of the arena. So Mia's like, do I kill the Silken now that I've got like the advantage? Or do I save Bladesinger? And she saves Bladesinger. So we know that our little Mia is still in there.
Yeah.
So as they're holding on for dear life, the Silken is sort of stalking towards them and they know that death is coming and Mia is begging Furion to call the shadows to stop her. And it's enough to get Bladesinger over the edge because Furion's like, okay, fuck it. You know, I am just sizzling to death over here with the acidic burning into my throat, but I'll help you this one time.
It's
about fucking time, Furion.
Seriously, Furion.
Seriously. How much easier would this have been if you'd just pulled your fucking head out your ass? Because really, at the end of the day, you fucking died anyway, you useless piece of cunt.
Oh, she's angry. Okay, so we're getting Bladesinger back over the edge. The Silken's there and slices her back, which doesn't sound nice. Mia dodges and cuts off an arm and then yeets its head off. She's just like, off with your head, off. There you go.
Dance to your
That's it. They won. Fantastic. Good times ahead. It means that the berth in the Magni is now assured. But now it's like, okay, well, cool. You've got one Gladiati with a fucked up neck situation and you've got another one with a fucked up back situation. So
really, he had one shot, one opportunity to seize everything you've ever wanted.
Would you capture it or would you just let it slip?
Okay, so then we're in book three, the game. And basically after the fight, they're essentially holding Furion down while they try to treat his injuries from, you know, the silkling acid spit. And Mia ends up basically stepping up with her potion experience to basically knock him the fuck out. But as she steps up, their shadows bleed together and she can feel his pain. The quote we get is, blood on her hands, in her eyes, the taste of a bitter medicine she'd never drunk on her tongue. She looked down to her shadow, the shadow that should have been dark enough for three, but as the room swam before her eyes, as the pain of her wounds and the trauma of her ordeal in the arena and the shuddering aftermath rose up to sweep, a black curtain over her eyes, she realized it was dark enough for four.
Ooh.
Dun, dun, dun.
Mia promptly blacks the fuck out, and when we get back to Crow's Nest, Mia and Maggot have to try and save Furion's life. We find out why Maggot is called Maggot. Plot twist, she has a bucket of maggots.
It's not just because she likes to get really maggot on the weekends.
Yeah.
Maggoted.
Absolutely. Oh. Leona Lewis basically refuses to leave Furion's side because he's bleeding with love now, so it's just a whole vibe. Arcades decides that's a bit sus. And snoops and then finds Leona's underwear in Furion's bed. And the magistrate sees him like storming off with her undies. So that's a vibe.
He's wearing them.
Actually my size. I love the feel.
Anyway, so the next chapter, things are still dark in the Collegium. Mia is trying to convince herself that they are not her friends, but it is getting very hard to believe that, especially because she just saved Bladesinger, you know?
Yeah.
A messenger arrives to read aloud a message from Leona Lewis's father, Liam Neeson.
That's right. We're calling him Liam Neeson. I forgot about that.
Basically says, like, Ayo, you remember that debt that you owed? Well, yeah, don't worry about it. I bought it, and now you have to pay me back. Otherwise, I'm taking everything you own. And basically, the message ends with, I should have beaten you harder and more often. So that's super sick. But, like, hey, super nice of him to leave her a gift, right? Like a bottle of wine, right? No, you're fucking wrong. Because we find out later that her father actually beat her mother to death with that same bottle of fucking wine. So big yikes.
Yeah.
Yeah, look, that's a real dick move.
Literally is like, see this bottle of wine? Yes.
Is it a bit triggering?
It's really unfortunate. Really unfortunate.
Yeah,
we've seen bottles of wine used in a myriad of ways on this podcast.
We have indeed.
Not by dads. We've got one to add to the collection.
Not by dads. By stepbrothers. So Arcades offers himself as comfort to Leona Lewis, and she turns him down. We then see that the magistrate of the court tells Leona that Arcades knows.
Yeah.
But then, dun dun dun, their dinner is poisoned. Sick. Mia rushes to make a cure, but it's too late and Maggot is dead.
Is maggoted.
Oh my god. Maggot is now maggoted. She's a maggot.
But she's a maggot.
Also, her death felt very unnecessary. I feel like we didn't achieve much with it other than discovering the murderer of... But again, you didn't have to kill her.
Yeah, very but look, no one is safe. So no. Bang, Maggot, and some guy called Otho died from the poison.
We haven't really even mentioned Fang properly.
Fang
was a dog, which again, I know it's very surprising that we didn't get into a lot of love for this dog. I just imagine it like Fang from Harry Potter, like Hagrid's dog.
Yes.
And that was Arcady's dog, but unfortunately, he is now dead. R.I.P. Fang. Mia was basically able to save everyone else other than those three. Arcady's tries to blame Mia for the poisoning, but like, all signs point to it being Leona Lewis's dad, Liam Neeson. Mia then suggests that someone was paid off, and so the house is then searched. And the guards find Leona Lewis's undies in Arcady's bedroom, along with a vial of poison. And Leona Lewis turns on him and banishes him from the Collegium. Sid overhears Leona Lewis arranging for, like, basically that fleshmonger from that pit fight to come back and to attend for dinner. And essentially everyone but Mia and Furion are on the chopping block. Sid suggests rebellion and then drops a bombshell that, like, Mia's father was gay and in love with his general, and her parents' marriage was all about ambition. So that just, like, comes out of nowhere. And Mia is
super shocking.
Yeah. And then we learn why Sid is carved up as a coward and a traitor. He was basically loyal to Mia's daddy, but their plan would have resulted in such a loss of life that he spoke up and was against it. And he was nearly beaten to death, carved up, and then sold into slavery. But he would still make that decision, though, and his conscience is clear.
I love him. I love him so much.
No regrets.
No regrets, if you will.
So Mr. Kindly and Mia are disagreeing on what she should do now. So Mia ends up sending her passengers to go, like, guard so she can go in and see Ashlyn. And Ash, she's a little bit worried because she's now got this, like, nasty scar on her face after the fight with the Silken.
Mm.
And she's a bit worried about what Ash is going to think, because ordinarily she'd just go see the Weaver and the Weaver would just work her shit and she'd be all magicked away. But yeah. Ash says to her, "Our scars are just gifts from our enemies," Ashlyn whispered into her mouth, reminding us they weren't good enough to kill us.
Fuck it up, Ash. Like Jesus, that. I like that.
Quite like it.
Fuck it up.
So Ash says that Mia is the bravest person that she knows and that she was scared for her. And Mia's like, "That's sweet, but do you remember that time that you killed my boyfriend?" And it's like, oh, man. Like, I know. Do we keep having to rehash the past? Like, we all make choices. That was a particularly bad one. Like, fucking hell. So the moment is disrupted as the passengers come running to Mia to let her know that Furion is awake and Mia needs to leg it back to the Collegium because she knows that they're going to try and come to get her to help Furion. And she's like, "Well, fuck, I'm not there." So she makes it back in time and she goes to see Furion and they have a moment where they're sort of like making a bit of peace. They don't want to fuck each other, which is okay, but they're
not hating each other. In that moment.
So, progress. We learn a bit more about Furion's backstory, and it turns out he was, in fact, a thief, a rapist, and a murderer, which was good. Nice.
And a slave trader.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yes, in the capacity of a slave trader. So, that's good. So, essentially, he caught a priest. He caught a priest as a slave, and he was meant to...
He's just standing outside. Remember that giant guy with the giant dick who was hitting people with, like, a conch? He's actually just got a giant net, and he's just capturing them as they come out, the brethren, as they're coming out of the church.
He's like, "Oh, my God, I'd really like to be called my brother in Christ. Get over here."
Pretty much. So he's called himself a little priest, and, well, he was going to yeet the priest when they got to their destination, but then he was like, "You're a good time. I'm going to keep you around for a while." So a year later, he's now converted into the religion, and that is how cults work, my friend.
Mm-hmm.
So
surprise.
You think you're killing them, but really they're killing you.
Exactly. Right. So Mia's like, "Well, that's all just a little bit silly. Like, now you want to sell yourself to be a slave and a gladiator just to, like, penance for what you did. Like, that's not going to make you feel any better. You're still killing people. Now you're just killing people differently." Mm. But here we are. Again, a man's logic.
Yeah.
So Mia returns to her cell and tells Sid that she is on board with the rebellion.
So we jump to the next chapter and we're in Sid's POV here. He's wondering if he can trust Mia, but there's no time because the sale is happening of him and the others, like, ASAP. Mia gets them out and they're making their way to, like, a ship that's, like, been hidden when a red-haired girl recognizes Mia and calls out to her. The guards are drawn by the attention and shit goes sideways. Mia turns on them and basically hands them over to Leona Lewis. To summarize, it's a whole moment. It's actually really sick. I, like, really actually was gobsmacked by this and it took me for a sixer.
You were. I was getting the Snapchat updates from Georgia. She was reading this and she was like, "Oh my God, you just betrayed them." And I was like, "Ah, just wait."
It was written really well though. Like, it didn't feel like a cheap little disguise plot. It was really good.
Yeah. And there was a lot of, like, leading up to this, you've had her being very conflicted, trying to be like, they are a means to an end, but she's obviously feeling more for them, like, they're her friends, and then also her privilege and looking at the world. And there's a lot of other things that lead up to this. I think it's handled really well. We then have this random ass chapter where we're in the point of view of Mr. Kindly and Eclipse. And Mr. Kindly wonders if they should fear for what they are turning Mia into. And Eclipse is like, no.
Yeah, pretty much.
Shut the fuck up, you stupid cat.
Yeah, literally.
The next chapter, Mia is out at sea with Leona Lewis. They're screaming into the sea, bleeding love. It's beautiful.
Yeah, Leona's like, you should try this. It's really therapeutic. Yeah,
it really gets out that anger and stuff.
Yeah, it's very cathartic. Instead of, like,
wielding that blade. So the others are in shackles besides basically her and Furion. Furion approaches her and asks why she did it. And she's like, because I'm not a fucking hero and I need to be here. And he asks her why she's here and she just doesn't answer him. They're on their way to the Magnai because it's motherfucking time. Mercurio comes to visit Mia. They embrace. Mia says, thank you, Mercurio is like, Mia, make sure you don't die. And she's like, I don't plan on it. And we get this moment where Mia says, you once told me I'd never be a hero. Mercurio's eyes filled with tears. He wrapped her up in a tight embrace, pulled her close to his chest. And there in the dark, just the pair of them, holding the girl he thought of as his own, the old man whispered, I might have lied.
Oh, Daddy! Pedro Pascal!
Oh my god, I love it!
Look at you being emotionally available, I love it. We then get one of those scenes where each paragraph is a mirror, which I love. Like, that's how book one started, so I love that we had this again. And it's, like, Furion is summoned by Leona to her bed, and she's like, hello, lover. Whereas Ashlyn appears in Mia's cell and Mia greets her with a hello, lover. Leona is like, I want you, Furion. I need you, Furion. I own you, Furion. And he stops her. Whereas Ash says to Mia, I want you. I need you. I love you. And Mia says, don't stop.
I love it. Oh.
So now, after a little quick orgasm, it's time for Mia to execute the others. Dun, dun, dun.
Nice.
Before she leaves, Mia sheds her mask slightly and puts Leona in her place, which is like, fucking finally. We have this quote.
Yes.
I might have been like you. If fates were kinder and crueler, I know what happened to your mother. I know what kind of childhood you had. All the things you are for a reason. Vicious and generous, courageous and pitiless. I like you and I hate you, and I couldn't have done this without you. So when the turn is done, I'll give you all the thanks I can muster. You won't think it nearly enough, I'm sure, but it's all I can fashion for you, Leona Lewis. I like it.
It's nice.
Mia is then armed and ready to execute the others, and Ash is dressed up as a guard, and she's the one giving her the weapons. The other gladiators call Mia names, but she is just there to get it done. She just can't fuck around. We then go to the point of view of Leona Lewis, who's up in the stands watching this all unfold. And her daddy, Liam Neeson, tries to shame her. But Leona says he should feel more shame for beating her mother to death. And it's like, true.
That's correct, actually.
And I love how it goes, like, oddly silent. Everyone's like,
oh, shit.
Okay, she took it serious. All right.
We were just having fun. It was just a joke. Why don't you have a sense of humor?
It was just a joke.
Well, the magistrate then goes, you probably shouldn't speak that way about your father. And it's like, shut the fuck up, old woman. No one asked you for your opinion.
Yeah, you're seeming a bit sus, magistrate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the execution match then starts and Mia is taking them out one by one. And it's over very quickly from there. And my heart this entire time, I was like, I'm sorry. No. I'm not on board with this venture. I'm like, no. And it felt so real, especially with the blood and they were dragging their corpses away. And I was like, oh, my God.
Honestly, yep. I was Snapchatting Bryony, like, screaming. Like, I was honestly, I was so angry. I was furious. I was like, Furion, if you will. But I was furious.
Actually your brother in Christ. Mia is then trying to wash the blood from her hands as she replays Sid's last words to her. Good luck. So you're like, oh, that's interesting. If you were killing him, that's interesting. But it's time. And the Magnai is about to start. And it's basically last man standing wins. So they enter the arena. And then Scabby arrives with his wife and young son. And then the Domo guy leads a prayer, basically confirming all of Mia's targets are now where they were always meant to be. It's coming together. The arena begins to transform, and soon they are on like boats in water, and it's a reenactment of the Battle of Seawall, and there are like even storm drake creatures in the water. Oh no.
It's a reenactment of Step Brothers, I'm on a boat.
Mia turns to her brother in Christ and is like, I'm on a boat. Mia and Furion are surrounded by Liam Neeson's fighters and basically agree to have each other's backs until it's just them at the end. We're then in Mercurio's point of view, and he and Ash are working on something for Mia, and he does the whole, if you hurt my daughter, I'll hurt you. And I love it. Furion and Mia survive the first attack by Liam Neeson's fighters, but their shadows are again doing the hanky-panky, which seems super sus. We're then in Leona Lewis's point of view, and she realizes that Mia is not using the dagger that she gave her. In fact, she is not using her dagger at all. Except, wait a minute, didn't she use that in the execution bout? So hold on. And like things are coming together. The fight is basically relentless, but more concerning than the fact that, like, you know, people are trying to kill Mia and Furion is the fact that Mia and Furion's shadows are now one. She can feel him, his intent, his pain, and Furion feels her too, but then they hear the darkness. And we get this quote, Mia could still sense Furion, their shadows utterly enmeshed, coiling around across the stone, dancing in the blood. It was as if she had two sets of eyes, two hearts, two minds, twice the strength, twice the will, twice the fury. World Eater swung his mattock at her head, and she felt Furion's hand on her own, guiding her counter. Furion struck at Ragnar, and he felt Mia's grip on his blade, coalescing, unending, no sense of where she ended and he began. There beneath those burning suns, if only for a moment, the puzzle seemed to have found its missing piece.
Jeez.
So these things are happening.
It's all confuzzled. Furion is being like choked out. And he's having a real good time. And Mia's like, oh, shit, I feel that too. Fuck yeah, let's go. She drops her dagger in like, you know, because she feels like she's being choked, you know. So drops her dagger and Furion grabs it to save himself only to discover that it's a theater knife. Jokes on him. Ashton Kutcher jumps out of the dagger.
You've been punked.
He is the dagger. Magic. Mercurio and Ashlyn are basically getting the gladiators from the morgue. And Belle is there to take them to Teardrinker to be marked as free people. And it's all coming together.
She didn't kill Sid the Sloth.
She fucking didn't kill him. And I was literally, I was thrown. Screaming, crying, throwing up. Like, it's brilliant. And Mia and Furion are the last two standing in the end. And Furion is like, you're a fucking liar and a traitor. And Mia's like, you can't wash your hands clean with more blood, Furion.
It's just common fucking sense, Furion.
Common sense. And he like lunges for her. And we get this quote, which is, we actually get a few quotes. But the first quote is, the dark beneath them clawed and tore at each other, ink black upon the bloody stone, hate and hunger and something close to sorrow. The shadow cat hissed and the shadow wolf growled and the girl, the blade, the gladiati struck, the tip of her sword catching the unfallen in the neck as he rushed past.
Woo. That was easy.
Bye. The quote goes on and we get, with a final gasp, the unfallen fell. A hammer blow to Mia's spine, a rush of blood in her veins, skin crawling, every nerve ending on fire. She fell to her knees, hair billowing about her as if in a phantom breeze, her shadows scrawled in maddened, jagged lines beneath her. Mr. Kindly and Eclipse and a thousand other forms scribbled among the shapes it drew upon the stone, a hunger inside her sated, the longing gone, the emptiness suddenly violently filled, a severing, an awakening, a communion painted in red and black. She then has some shrooms real quick and has a vision. She basically looks up at the sky and, like, even though she's in a broad fucking daylight with three suns, all of a sudden she's looking at a night sky. And has this voice say to her, the many were one and will be again. She looks at her shadow and it is dark enough for four.
Holy shemozzles.
Oh my gosh.
So we jump to the next chapter and Leona is watching Furion fall and Mia win and she's super conflicted. An old man comes up to her and offers her a bottle of wine. Her father, he's like, hey, you should actually drink this bottle of wine. Here's a cup. The magistrate tries to like scold him, but the man says that there's a special place in hell for those who kill little girls. Mia has like left a calling card for Leona inside the like goblet of wine, and Leona like finally figures it out. Mercurio tells her where to find Arcades should she want to go on the run, as they will kill her for what comes next. So Leona's like, all right, peace out. Mia is basically on the podium ready to accept her reward, aka murder the leaders of the government.
Nice.
Scabby brings his son with him and it's like cute, nice family outing. We love that for him.
Yeah. It's just like some weird fucked up parenting going on there, but sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The cardinal doesn't recognize Mia, but as she gets closer to Scabby, she feels it. You know, that hunger that she gets every time she looks at a fucking Darkin, and she's looking and looking, and then we realize that Scavia's son is a Darkin. And not only that, Scavia's son is Mia's baby brother. The quote we get is,
oh my
father,
God.
The boy on Scabby's shoulders asked, yes, my son, the consul replied. The child narrowed his ink-black eyes, looking right at Mia. I'm hungry.
Oh, that's like terrifying.
That is that fucking is scary.
Terrifying.
I don't like children.
That's
oh going to
be
God.
In my nightmares for the next fucking 6 years. Thanks.
Actually cool.
I much horror. Preferred it when I thought she was going to fuck her brother. Anyway.
Oh, God.
Well, you don't fucking know. This is the whole problem. With the Darkens, she acts like she wants to fuck them 1 minute and then, like, eat them the next. So I'm very concerned about this entire situation.
Honestly.
I mean, pasta makes me horny too, but, yeah, it's just...
You know, you don't see me trying to fuck it.
No. Duomo is like, congrats on winning and please tell us your name. And she stands up and she's like, my fucking name is Mia motherfucking Corvair. And then she slices his throat from ear to ear. It's amazing. It's
fuck
quite
it up, sis. Jesus.
Really enjoyed that. And then she goes for Skaver. And like all of the guards are charging at her, but she's faster. Then she's running at him with his sword. And he's just like, fuck this kid. And literally throws the child at her.
He's like, you're just...
Oh my God. I didn't understand it then. And I still don't understand it now when we realize who this person is. Like,
well,
why on earth would you throw a child at it?
Well, to be fair, it is like a random guy who's been made to look like the child's
but
dad.
But still, it's a
child. Has no attachment to the child. If he's picking this random guy, it's like, I pick my life.
Okay. Well, it's okay because she catches the kid. And, like, in one motion, she's spinning around and stabbing him in the throat. And it's beautiful. It's all over. And I'm like, how the hell is she going to get out of this? Well, I'll tell you how. She's shadow walking her way, like Michael Jackson, back into a different realm. The arena is then in chaos because all of their sanguila have started puking up blood. Which, good on them. So all the good gladiator houses have now been gutted of their leadership in just one moment. And, of course, the leader of the church and the leader of the people are now laying dead as well. So it's a lot. A lot just happened in 5 minutes.
Yeah. So Mia's on her way out. She's yeeting. And Ash is in the city when panic starts. And so she knows that Mia succeeded in her plan. She basically is following the plan and gets to Mercurio's shop to grab like the last things. But then what do you know? Drusilla is there. In fact, the entire Red Church ministry is there and they've taken Mercurio. But wait, someone else is also there and it is Scabby. And Ashlyn basically realizes the plan that Scavia, aka Scabby, had basically planned all of this with the church from the beginning. He wanted the cardinal dead, but couldn't have the church kill him, so he needed someone with those skills, but someone that was willing to betray the ministry, so that way the church's reputation stays intact. All the while, if he survives this assassination attempt, like, the people adore him more, so it's just a win-win-win for him. But then we get another bombshell, and it's that Mia is Scabby's daughter. So that's just a whole shooketh moment, and Ash is about to be taken away by the Red Church, basically as a lure for Mia. but she drops a literal bomb this time and just blows up the room and is running. But she takes a poison dagger to the thigh and is like just about to drop when she again hits the fan. There's a lot of shit everywhere. Again, Death Shitter is just sugar. Ash is then saved by the same creature that saved Mia at the beginning of the book. And we end the book with this quote, right? Are we ready? "Who are you?" The thing peeled back its hood, pallid skin, salt locks writhing like living things, pitch black and hollow eyes, but even with the poison swimming in her veins, all the world around her fading to black, Ashlyn would recognize his face anywhere. "Hello, Ashlyn," he said. "Biss and blood," she breathed, the darkness closing in. Trick?
Why has he got tentacles on his face? Yay. I have so many questions.
Dead. He got so true, many questions. And that's the end of Bosgrave. Book 2 in the series. Jay, you did good. You did really fucking good.
So I've got a music reference, and it's kind of an album this week rather than specific songs. And I feel like the album that really embodies this book is Demi Lovato's new album. I don't know if anyone's listened to it, but it's really like more heavy metal, like not heavy metal, but like metal punk rock. And it's basically all about how she's just fucking society. And she's like stepping into her sexuality and she's like, what of it?
Fucking
awesome. Yeah. Really, really like it. So there's a song called Eat Me, which I think is just Mia.
Yeah.
It's just, it fits in a lot of ways.
Amazing. Then we're on to fan art. So we have basically two pieces by POL Arts _. The first one is Ashlyn with the map on her back and her war braids. Like, and then we have this one of Mia at the winnowing. So she's kind of like in her bandage attire where before she's got armor. Then we've got by Gonzalom, full stop art. We've got Mia as the crow because FYI, in case we didn't mention it, her gladiator name was Crow. No one knew until that final moment that her name was Mia other than Sid when he figured it out. So,
oh my fucking God, it's so fucking hot.
Gonzalom.art, that is phenomenal. Then we've got by Nanfee1789, we've got, you know, dead risen trick vibes with his salt locks and he's looking a bit goth as fuck. Then by Morgana Zero Anagram, we've got Mia the Crow again. So it's like all black and white, but the blood is in red. And it's very cool. And then by Adamar.art, we have Mia and Ashlyn in bed.
I love that.
That is so cute. I really like Mia in that. That's like how I pictured her.
Yeah. And then we've got a piece done by Damien full stop in full stop the full stop den. So Damien in the den, but it was for a touch of magic designs. And that is Mia the Crow in like gladiator armor.
Smash. Fucking smash.
So that is fan art for Godsgrave. There's some other stuff out there. You know me, I like to try and be very specific to the book we're covering. So try to just pick scenes from what we've covered. Hey, Georgia, want to tell us what we're reading next?
Oh, bitches. Next week, we are covering Icebreaker by Hannah Grace. And when I tell you that I read this book last year, and it was by far my favorite full stop rom-com romance of 2022. Hands down, it was so fucking good. I gobbled that shit up and
gobbled.
Now rereading, it is just perfection, perfection, perfection. Like, so good.
It is so good.
Get ready for a good fucking episode. It's smutty. It's like fluffy. It's like enemies to lovers, grumpy sunshine, like hockey, figure skating.
I've never loved a sport more.
Honestly.
Bryony was already weirdly obsessed with figure skating, so we're in for a time, guys.
True. But yeah, so that is next week.
Well, thank you so much for listening to another episode, guys, and we're so excited to be back next week with Icebreaker. And yeah, peace out, A-Town. Don't fuck your brothers in Christ.
Please don't.
Please don't.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. You can find us on Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube if you haven't already at A Book and a Bev Podcast.
Please rate, like, and subscribe. We hear that helps.
We love and appreciate you, and we'll see you next week.